Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NPR member stations, and NPR. You know who this clarinetist is. I bet you don't know his real name. His closest friends and colleagues even have a hard time getting their arms around it.
Boniface, I'm not sure.
Boniface and Leonardo and all those other...
Francesco, some long Italian thing.
Bonifaci.
Bonifacio Ferdinando.
Bonifacio Leonardo Fernando De Franco is his name.
Oh, that's a marvelous name. I mean, he could open a restaurant with that name.
Bonifacio Fernando Leonardo DiFranco.
Isn't that beautiful? There's a song right there.
It probably could be a song, but it's a mouthful for most people. And that's why he's always been Buddy DiFranco. He's a tall, soft-spoken Italian from South Philadelphia who took an instrument that was firmly rooted in the swing era and courageously transplanted it into the thick of bebop.
People were talking about, hey, here's this guy who plays bebop clarinet.
Writer Ira Gittler.
All I can say is when you mention modern jazz clarinet, the first one you think of is Buddy DiFranco.
Buddy's an individual. Buddy was the first bebop clarinet player and probably the best bebop clarinet player.
Vibraphonist Terry Gibbs.
The style he plays is the swinginest and for me, the best.
His sound has been called liquid smooth and pinpoint precise.
This sound is identifiable from any source, from any angle, from any group that he's played in.
Trumpeter Clark Terry.
And I've known Buddy for a lot of years, so he's been mastering that stick for a long time.
The minute I heard that sound, I knew right away he was in a class with Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw.
Drummer Louis Belson.
But Buddy was always one to develop his own sound. It had the warm sound that Benny had. It had the technical sound that Artie Shaw had. But yet, it was Buddy DiFranco playing all the licks that Charlie Parker could play on the alto saxophone.
It's impossible to be a clarinet player after Buddy DiFranco without being influenced by Buddy DiFranco.
Clarinetist Ron Aldridge.
He's that strong, and he's that preeminent in the field. He is the guru of modern jazz clarinet playing.
The guru, the father, the Charlie Parker of the clarinet. These are all accolades bestowed upon this statesman of jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, a 75th birthday tribute to clarinetist Buddy DiFranco. Clarinet has been subject to more popularity surges and crashes than most other instruments in jazz. In the swing era, it was king. In the decades following, it slipped back into the shadows. What is it about the instrument that makes it so elusive for both listener and player? Clarinetist Eddie Daniels.
Well, the instrument has unlimited potential. It has a certain quality of sound that keeps evading you. You know, it's like being in a relationship where you don't get everything you want all the time, but you stay in it because you hope you're going to get it. So that's how the clarinet is. You get it some days and then other days you don't get it. But you know that you can get it, and when you get it, it's beautiful.
lot of people who listen to jazz, and for that matter who play it, like a sense of excitement.
Jazz writer and critic Nat Hentoff.
Immediate excitement, which can be lasting if you're any good, and that's why the tenor saxophone is a very popular instrument among players and audiences, and so is the alto saxophone. The clarinet is a more subtle instrument, and it requires somewhat closer listening than if you're just nodding your head and stomping your feet to a tenor.
Its subtlety is its power, but in the hands of a novice, the instrument is anything but subtle.
We're all accustomed to hearing clarinets squeak.
Again, clarinetist Eddie Daniels.
And most of the people that I know who gave up the clarinet did so because it squeaked, it was hard to handle, it's like a snake that gets in your hands and slips away.
It requires that you play it correctly.
Buddy DeFranco.
But you've got to know how far to go too far when you're playing jazz. Because jazz predetermines that you abuse the instrument. You're really defying the nature of the clarinet. It's such a constrained, rigid instrument that you have to work hard to give it that flexibility that's necessary to play jazz. And it takes somebody who's determined.
And determined is one thing that Buddy DeFranco has always been, even as a little kid back in South Philadelphia.
As silly as it sounds now, I really loved to practice. Our neighbors were, this is a rumor, but I think it's close to the truth that they signed a petition against me practicing so much because whenever I was at home, I was practicing, day and night, didn't matter, you know.
Born February 17, 1923, Buddy DeFranco loved music from day one. His first instrument was the mandolin, but what he really wanted to play was the saxophone. A wise friend of his father, though, suggested that he begin with the clarinet, the more difficult reed instrument. So at the age of 9, clarinet it was.
The first clarinet I got, my dad used $25, which was the month's rent, to buy a clarinet for me. And it was a funny clarinet. We got it at a hock shop. The bottom was made of plastic. The top was made of wood. It was a mongrel. But it served the purpose. And my father's brother, my uncle, was so angry with my dad for spending rent money for my clarinet that he wouldn't talk to him for 6 months or a year. He wouldn't speak to him. I thought that was outrageous, you know.
Those were tough times. It was the 1930s and the midst of the Depression. Leonard DeFranco earned a meager living as a piano tuner. He was the single parent of 5 young children, and he was blind.
My dad had a band comprised of all blind people, and they called themselves the Jovial Night Owls. He did some amazing things, and my brother and I would take turns taking him out to tune pianos after school, during the weekends, and during the summer. Sometimes my brother and I would be a little bit late and getting ready to go out, and he'd grab his cane and walk out, and that was it. We wouldn't see him. But he would go on his own with his cane all over the city. Yeah, he was kind of a hero of mine. Yeah.
Even though there was often not enough food on the table or warm clothes for winter, there was always an abundance of music in the DeFranco home. Buddy's Italian grandparents loved opera. His father listened to big band music and loved the artful Art Tatum. Music was a respite from life's problems, even for the children.
I lived in South Philadelphia, and there were pockets of nationality neighborhoods, you know, an Italian neighborhood, Irish, black neighborhood, Jewish neighborhood. And we all knew each other, and we all had a common bond, which was music. And so it was very common for us to get together and play and have private jam sessions in somebody's cellar or somebody's living room. And when I was about 12, we organized a big band. We played Italian weddings and serenades and bar mitzvahs and Polish dances and everything possible.
But he also began to pursue classical music. After junior high, he made the significant decision to forego regular public high school to study at the esteemed Massbaum School, where many reputed Philadelphia musicians got their start. The training was strictly classical, or legitimate as it was known in those days, suggesting that all other music was illegitimate. Buddy's longtime friend and former classmate, trumpeter Joe Wilder, recalls how jazz was frowned on by the superiors.
The most terrible thing you could do, you're playing Tchaikovsky or something, and we get to the finale of it in the last chord, and someone would add a flatted fifth or the seventh, and the director would be, I mean, it was as if you had just committed murder, and they're trying to find out who was the guilty party. You know, they would, who did that? This was like the worst thing you could possibly do. You know, it was, and we used to go off and laugh about it, how serious they would get about the fact, and guys, of course, would just do it to get them started, you know.
One of the most serious penalties that we would have to pay would be if we couldn't, we wanted to play the modern works like Stravinsky, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, but if we couldn't do that, didn't get through it, he said, okay, 1 week of Victor Herbert favorites. And everybody would say, no, anything but that. Beat us, but not that.
Buddy was appreciative of his classical training and was particularly interested in the 20th century Russian composers who would later greatly influence his harmonic thinking. But his enthusiasm for musicians like the king of swing himself, Benny Goodman, and the forward-looking Artie Shaw sold Buddy on pursuing jazz.
They were both great. You know, I mean, you couldn't pick two finer clarinet players in those days to glean something. I wound up really more interested in Artie's playing. I felt he was way ahead of his time. Benny would play a melody. He'd always phrase his melodies as with a lilting fashion, almost like he was dancing through this song. Artie, as opposed to that, would phrase like a violinist with a little more depth and a little more faithfulness to the melodic line. I love the way he played a melody, Artie Shaw.
Taking his cues from those swing masters like Artie Shaw, there in a 1936 recording of Sweet Lorraine, Buddy DeFranco, at age 14, got his first big break in the music business.
Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra, ladies and gentlemen, leading off with You Turn the Tables on Me. Edith Wright sings the chorus.
He auditioned for a national Tommy Dorsey swing contest and won a spot as one of the four finalists to compete on a live coast-to-coast radio broadcast. As they say, he had arrived, and his teacher helped him make the most of the opportunity.
He found out that I made the four finalists, and he said, well, you're going to win. He said, I'm going to make sure you win. He said, the way you're going to win is, he said, even though you just started wearing long trousers, now you're going to wear short trousers. You'll look a lot younger. And he said, I'll teach you how to play one note with one hand. And he said, and you put out your other hand. Show the people you're playing the last part with one hand. He says, that'll break it up. Well, he was right. It was funny. I was a very skinny young kid with a long clarinet and playing. It was a terrible solo. I remember it. But I was playing with one hand on finally to finish the solo. Those other contestants didn't have a chance. You know, it didn't matter what they could stand in their head. They couldn't win. You know. But Tommy was gracious, and he said, you know, stick around, kid. Someday you're going to play in my band.
And nobody, least of all Buddy, realized how significant Tommy Dorsey's comment would prove to be. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a 75th birthday tribute to Buddy DeFranco. I'm Nancy Wilson. After winning the Tommy Dorsey Swing Contest, Buddy began to gain local stature in Philadelphia. In 1939, bandleader Johnny Scat Davis heard him play and soon after signed guardianship papers to take him on the road at age 16. This was just the first of many important big band experiences he would have. In 1941, Gene Krupa stole him away, and in 1942, he joined Charlie Barnett. The word was getting out about Buddy DeFranco. Finally, in 1944, he got the call that Tommy Dorsey wanted him.
For my audition, Cy Oliver came in, and Cy said, sit there and get out these numbers, 25, 32, whatever. And he picked actually the most difficult numbers in the whole book. And then in the distance, I heard some sort of a fanfare. I thought it was anyway. And then came Tommy Dorsey with his entourage. Then Tommy said, I told you you were going to play in my band. Remember that? And I said, yeah. And then he said, don't think you got it made, because if you don't cut it, you're out. And that also threw another shock into me. But I got through it. I did.
The Tommy Dorsey Band was one of the most popular dance bands in America. They were featured regularly on radio broadcasts. They sold truckloads of recordings, and they played dance halls throughout the country. Fellow band member, Louis Belson.
Playing with Tommy's band was a real joy. Perfectionist. And he loved Buddy DeFranco because Buddy was such a great player, and he showcased him. In those days, the singers were secondary. The instrumentalists were the big ones.
The instrumentalists became the popular stars of the day, and clarinet was the king of instruments. Jazz writer Ira Gittler.
Clarinet was almost symbolic of at least a great portion of the big band era because of the success of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw. And they were two of the biggest band leaders, and they played clarinet. And let's face it, the big bands were that era's counterpart of the rock stars. All these bands had their fan clubs, and the fans could tell you who played second alto or third tenor or baritone sax in the band. They could give you the whole roster. It was serious stuff. That was the popular music of America.
Tommy Dorsey's band, self-admittedly, was a popular dance band, not a jazz band. And this became somewhat of a source of conflict for Buddy.
I was set on trying to keep changing whatever I was playing. I wanted to change, develop it. And Tommy Dorsey said, you know, there's the record of Opus One is getting hot, so keep the solo the same. I did for a while, but then I got bored with it. You know, there again, six times playing that solo, which I didn't like in the first place, but I was stuck with it. It was on the record. So I changed it a few times. One time he wasn't feeling too well, and I went off on a tangent, played completely different solo, and he said, no, that won't do, this won't do. I said, well, it's not creative, you know, six times a day, the same solo. He says, well, you can be creative on somebody else's band. He said, you're fired, which he did. He fired me.
But he was out on the street, running up bills in dire straits, and after a few months, totally broke.
I had no money. I mean, no money. That's it. And Tommy Dorsey called. I heard his voice, and he said, I won't use his language, but he said, you got enough wrinkles in your belly? I need a clarinet player on this band. Want to come back? You're starving enough. And at the same time, one of the few times I used my head, I said, well, I'm doing great, and I'm making some fantastic connections. And he heard this, and he said, all right, you know, what do you want? I said, well, I want $350 a week. He says, okay. I said, wait a minute. He said, what else, thief? He called me a thief. I said, I want everything extra, because in those days, you would say $350. You would wind up doing movies and radio shows and recordings for the same $350. So I said, all extras. Then he said, okay, thief, you got it. I said, do I have your word that I have? He said, what? You have my word. I said, okay, wire 500. And he flipped out. He yelled at his manager, Dave Jacobs. I could hear him yelling, the idiot is broke. He's broke. I knew it. So I said, I got your word. So okay. So he did. He wired the money, and I joined.
Thank you. Opus 1, recorded in 1944, one of the Dorsey Band's all-time biggest hits. Buddy's tenure with Tommy Dorsey, though fruitful, would remain limited because in the mid-40s, changes in the jazz world were soaring through the air in the form of a bird.
It was Charlie Shavers that told us about Charlie Parker. He said, there's a guy up in uptown Harlem playing something else. I don't know what he's doing, but I'm going to go up. I didn't meet him then. I just heard him. But he was skinny and wore dark glasses, had a big mop of hair. And I think at that time he was playing on a borrowed saxophone. Wasn't his horn, but it was unbelievable what he did. Unbelievable, because I was convinced from that time on that that was the way jazz was going to be played.
When bebop first started with Dizzy and Charlie Parker, everybody, even myself, we wondered, man, that's kind of strange music, you know?
Drummer Louis Belson.
But we didn't put it down. We kept saying, let me hear that again, you know, because wait a minute, here's two guys playing some notes, and the way they're playing them, we never heard that kind of style before. And Buddy was able to pick up on that right away. He knew the genius of Charlie Parker and Dizzy right away, you know?
As the bebop movement, led by Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, took hold in the 1940s, the big bands began to disappear. Tommy Dorsey, like many other band leaders, had resisted the changes, but the new movement was too great.
What he feared turned out to be true. We, as a beboppers, we had to go in our direction. That was it. But we also knew that we were going to knock out most of our audience because they couldn't dance to this music.
As Charlie Parker did for the saxophone, Dizzy Gillespie for the trumpet, and J.J. Johnson for the trombone, Buddy DeFranco took the clarinet from swing to bop. That's just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a 75th birthday tribute to Buddy DeFranco on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio.
Musicians say, yeah, you can play bebop on the alto like Bird, but it won't work on the tenor.
Writer Ira Gittler.
I mean, it has nothing to do with the instrument. It has to do with the musician and his ability to, assume the conception.
Buddy DeFranco's conception of bebop was entirely based on Charlie Parker's playing. As the two grew to be friends, Buddy listened to him every chance he got. He studied him, tried to get Bird's sound in his head. He even thought saxophone when he played.
Buddy himself would say that he likes the feeling when he blows the clarinet, he wants it to feel like an alto saxophone. It doesn't sound like a saxophone, it's still a clarinet, but that he wants that freedom on the clarinet of a saxophone. And that's basically what we all want on the clarinet when we play jazz.
Bebop was all about freedom. Freedom of harmony, freedom of rhythm, freedom from many of the rules of the swing era.
It was more fascinating and interesting than jazz had been before that.
Buddy DeFranco.
With the original swing beat, you're in shackles to that beat, and that's it. And so you can't escape a certain way of playing. But with bop, you have that freedom to float.
But the freedom to float and the ability to float are two very different things, and clarinet poses extraordinary challenges to its players.
If you play too legitimate, so to speak, then you're going to get a cold quality to whatever you play. If you go too far, loosen your embouchure to the extent where it's too close to the saxophone, then you get a raucous sound. So to get through those barriers on the clarinet is the most difficult thing to do.
Because of the instrument's difficulty, there were very few clarinetists who attempted to play bebop at all, and even fewer who succeeded. Buddy was like a lone lighthouse, shining for everyone to see. He quickly built a strong reputation, appearing with all the leading beboppers of the day, and began to show up in the downbeat and metronome polls, soon climbing above Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw. With this attention came recording opportunities, like this metronome all-star session in 1949, with trumpeters Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, and Fats Navarro, trombonist Kai Winding and J.J. Johnson, pianist Lenny Tristano, and Charlie Parker. Overtime, from a metronome all-stars session in 1949. While playing the club scene in New York was exciting business, it was not easy to continue to drum up gigs. In 1950, Buddy found a steady partnership with a tight-knit group of musicians that became like a family to him, the Count Basie Septet. Musically, it was a great learning experience. Socially, it was a difficult learning experience because Buddy was the only white musician in this all-black group at a time when integrated bands were still unusual enough to cause great strife amongst the public.
I used to get threatening calls, got all sorts of rotten calls about being the only white guy in Basie's band and the only, why don't I stay on my side of the street? But never from the band. We got along great and had a good time. It was like a family.
Trumpeter Clark Terry.
There was never any problem within the realm of the players themselves, whether it be black or white or polka dot or green or whatever. But the people, even when you would go in the Southland to play, the audience would be roped off, you know, black people on one side, white people on the other side. They just would not allow fraternizing, as they called it. Humanizing is a better word.
Both Clark and Buddy vividly recall the same event as bringing the absurdity of those prejudiced times into high relief.
I did a tape for a TV with Count Basie's group.
A little short film with Billie Holiday and Sugar Child Robinson and Basie's small group.
We recorded the tape for it first and then we'd sync it later.
And to show you how stupid things were in those days, we had made the soundtrack, got ready to do the filming, and the powers that be said, no, we can't do that. We can't film a white musician with a black group. So what are we going to do? We've already made the soundtrack, so they got to find somebody to take Buddy's place for the filming.
And they brought in Marshall Royal to sync me playing. The funniest thing about all of this, and ridiculous thing about it, is Marshall Royal actually looked whiter than I did.
Marshall Royal on any warm day, Buddy DeFranco would look darker than him.
That's just so how stupid they were.
But they got him in because he was a black guy, and they could sell it down south, you know.
If Buddy had stayed in the sun about two more days, he'd have to go to the back of the bus, and Marshall would go to the front.
Buddy DeFranco in 1950 with the Count Basie Band. The Basie Band was the first of many integrated small groups in which Buddy would play during the 50s, a very prolific decade for him.
Buddy DeFranco and Oscar Peterson are at the Blue Note, and so is NBC.
Buddy formed his own quartet in 1952, hiring drummer Art Blakey, pianist Kenny Drew, and bassist Eugene Wright, and, in his words, they burned a lot of stages together.
Buddy DeFranco, his famous clarinet and his quartet. It's what you've been waiting for, and here waiting to greet you, Buddy DeFranco.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, we're having a wonderful time here at the Blue Note. It's our opening night. It certainly is a pleasure to see George Shearing, his very lovely wife, and John Levy, Irving Siders, and everybody. We'd like to get things underway now, ladies and gentlemen, and a little arrangement by the very wonderful Bud Powell. Somebody Loves Me.
Somebody Loves Me, from a live 1953 NBC broadcast from Chicago's Blue Note, with drummer Art Blakey, pianist Kenny Drew, and bassist Eugene Wright. In 1954, Buddy played to European audiences with another jazz luminary.
Dr. Billie Holiday. Jetzt für unser Finale bringen wir Red Norvo, Buddy DeFranco und Beryl Booker, Jimmy Rainey und Sonny Clark zusammen mit Miss Holiday für eine Jam-Session.
Writer-Critic Leonard Feather put together a tour for Buddy with Billie Holiday, whom Buddy had known closely from New York.
My man wouldn't give me no breakfast, wouldn't give me no dinner, squawked about my supper, then he put me outdoors. Matchbox on my clothes. I didn't have so many, but I had a long, long ways to go.
Billy's Blues, recorded live in Cologne, Germany, 1954. In 1956, producer Norman Granz paired Buddy with his boyhood idol, Art Tatum, in one of the most intense recording sessions of his career.
I was intimidated, I was nervous, but I was determined to stay with him, and it was like chasing a train. You had to be on guard to stay with him because he was that quick.
Buddy DeFranco with Art Tatum in 1956. Norman Granz also featured Buddy with his Jazz at the Philharmonic troupe.
Now we come to the Jazz at the Philharmonic quintet, and added to the Oscar Peterson trio is the greatest clarinetist in jazz today, Buddy DeFranco.
With a dream team rhythm section, pianist Oscar Peterson, bassist Ray Brown, guitarist Herb Ellis, and drummer Buddy Rich. Wow. Buddy DeFranco in 1954 with Oscar Peterson, Ray Brown, Herb Ellis, and Buddy Rich. Despite Buddy's enormous success during the 1950s, he was plagued with a criticism lodged by a prominent jazz writer, Nat Hentoff.
I mean, he was a very proficient musician. As a failed clarinetist, I did appreciate the fact that on every register, he never made mistakes. He articulated very cleanly. He knew exactly what he was doing. But I didn't hear him. That is, the personality, the thing that makes every important jazz musician important, that you sense who is telling you this story.
Nat Hentoff was the only critic to step forward with this view, deeming Buddy's playing as cold.
I don't know how you could call Buddy cold. He's such a warm human being, and I think it comes through in his playing.
Jazz writer Ira Gittler.
I mean, certainly Buddy throws himself into his improvisations, you know. There's no stinting. He goes all out. And I think he's a very passionate player.
Everybody that listens to something hears it differently from their own perspective. And you can't please everyone. Don't even try. Please yourself first, and then try to please those people around you that you feel know what you're doing. Don't forget, this is a big world, millions of people. And I think if anybody notices you at all, you're pretty lucky.
You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles. a 75th birthday tribute to Buddy DeFranco. I'm Nancy Wilson. Toward the end of the 1950s, in Buddy DeFranco's words, the jazz world was up for grabs. Rock and roll began to turn people's ears in a new direction, and as a result, jazz clubs all over the country began to fold. Living out in California at the time, Buddy turned to studio work, playing background music for TV shows like Route 66, Tom and Jerry cartoons, and various films. Opportunities to play for the public were scarce, until a turning point in 1966, when Buddy DeFranco was invited to lead the Glenn Miller Orchestra. With the Miller Orchestra, he played one-nighters for 50 weeks a year and still found time to meet and marry his wife, Joyce.
It was so fascinating, I was drawn into it. But not very many relationships would ever withstand 5 years of being that close. We never had a moment apart.
In 1974, Buddy and Joyce together decided that they'd had enough of the road and that Buddy should return to building a solo career. Since then, he has found himself in one of the best partnerships of his life with vibraphonist Terry Gibbs.
You know, Buddy happens to be Italian, I happen to be Jewish. And one of the first reviews we ever got, the headline was, "It's like a kosher pizza."
Their personalities, like their instruments, are about as different as could be, which may be the secret to their fantastic friendship. You know what they say, opposites attract.
We couldn't get along off stage, we couldn't play together on stage. No way. It's just like a marriage. If you couldn't get along with your wife, let me put it as hard as I can be and be as clean as I can be. If you couldn't get along during the daytime, have a good conversation, when you go to bed, there'll be nothing happening there. Does that make sense? We really love each other as people. We really do because we get along so well, and we play well because of that.
And we understand each other musically. He says, I'll quote him, "I keep him honest in playing, and he keeps me alive, so to speak." He generates so much energy that you feel it. And it rubs off. I like the idea of that steam. And you could see it when we play together. There's a lot of steam there.
Come 11 from the 1988 album Holiday for Swing with Terry Gibbs and Buddy DeFranco. These two may see eye to eye with their music, but could not have more drastically different approaches to their business.
Now, he happens to be the worst businessman in the world. He's a very honest person and he'll tell you exactly what he thinks at all times. But he's a terrible businessman. And here's a story that he told me. By the way, I handle all the business and you'll know why after this story. He told me he once got a call from somebody in Toronto, Canada, saying, "Mr. DeFranco, are you open January 2nd, whatever date?" And he says, "Yes, I am open." He says, "Wonderful. He says, I'd like to have you play in my club for me. By the way," he said, "I heard you played Montreal last week. How did it go?" And Buddy says, "I bombed. Nobody came in to see me." And the guy hung up on him immediately. "I bombed." I said, "Wait, let me ask you a question. What did you say that?" He says, "Well, it's true. Nobody came." I said, "Did the people who were there like what you played?" He said, "They gave me a standing ovation." I said, "Why didn't you tell the man they gave you a standing ovation?" So now when anybody calls him, he says, "Call Terry Gibbs," because he's terrible. He's probably one of the nicest people. He and Louis Belson, I mention both their names because they're both the same type of people. If they lived together, they'd both be poor and broke.
He's one of those guys that you say one word to him, he says, "Hello, how are you?" And you feel like a brother to him.
Drummer Louis Belson.
Everybody, Joe Williams, Terry Gibbs, Dizzy, anybody that had contact with Buddy DeFranco said he's one of the nicest men. And to have that kind of stature, that kind of a, like one of the greatest clarinet players that ever lived, and to have that beautiful personality, that's a rarity, you know?
Buddy has influenced a whole cadre of jazz clarinetists. Two of the most prominent in the world today, Eddie Daniels and German clarinetist Rolf Kühn. The three of them recently recorded together on an album of Rolf Kühn and friends, each clarinetist bringing something different to the mix. And as Eddie Daniels cites, Buddy brings something beyond his musical style to an ensemble.
The most important thing that Buddy brings anywhere is his personality, is his sweetness. There has to be a shared warmth, affection, and a camaraderie within the group, and that's what makes the music happen. And Buddy, being a soft, sweet person, helps that happen, especially with three guys who play the same instrument.
In this piece, Three Boppeteers, composed by Buddy just for this session, you can hear the differences in each clarinetist's sound, with Eddie Daniels soloing first, then Buddy, then Rolf. Three Boppeteers, written by Buddy DeFranco, recorded in 1997. Eddie Daniels and Rolf Kühn are two of many clarinetists Buddy has influenced over the years. Clarinetist and Dr. Ron Odrich.
He's one of those players, and they don't all fit into this category. He's one of those players who gets better and better and changes and progresses with time. A lot of guys get into a groove and they stay there. There are many, many jazz musicians who you could have heard in the 40s and hear now, and you wouldn't hear very much difference. Not with Buddy.
Too many jazz players in history have been a character of themselves in later years. And I try my best not to step into that ditch because that's the beginning of the termination of your career when you start cloning yourself to such an extent. We all play something of what we did before, there's no question about it. But as long as I have the physical abilities and am able to play the clarinet, I want to grow because there's got to be that little edge. That's the game.
He practices for at least 2 hours every day, and in doing so for over 65 years now, has carved out a place in history as not only the first modern jazz clarinetist, but as an educator, composer, arranger, and prolific musician with strong but simple convictions.
I hope to stand for an innovator of jazz clarinet and hope that that has influenced other parts of the music business and other instruments. I hope that tomorrow comes. I hope to feel pretty good for a long time. I always say I feel pretty good for a guy who feels pretty bad. And I feel younger than a guy who's pretty old. And I'd like to continue it.
Seventy-fifth birthday message for Buddy DeFranco is, keep on keeping on, Buddy.
Yeah, get a job, buddy. Get us. We're not working on your 75th birthday.
Keep swinging, buddy. Don't stop.
Many happy returns. Bonifacio, Ferdinando, Leonardo DeFranco. Our tribute to Buddy DeFranco was written and produced by Molly Murphy. Post-production engineer, Saraya Muhammad. Remote recording engineers, Ted Ancona and Paul Blakemore. Thanks also to Sean Fox and Drew Reynolds. Special thanks to John Keane, Bob Barrett, Stanley Drucker, and Joyce DeFranco. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Script consultant, Mary Beth Kirshner. Website coordinator, Bettina Owens. The Vice President for NPR's Cultural Programming is Murray Horwitz. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
I might have become famous if I just had Boniface. I could see it, you know. There he is now, Boniface and his orchestra. Or Bonifacio. That's a great title. I should have kept it.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. Next on Jazz Profiles, Randy Weston, Out of Africa.
When I hear Randy Weston play, I hear someone who has really taken the blues and gospel and filtered it through Monk and Duke Ellington and then gone back and looked at the African roots of all of that music and come up with something which is so personal that it's just unbelievable.
As composer and pianist Randy Weston enjoys his seventh decade, he's become a walking embodiment of jazz history. For Randy Weston, it's a spirit that goes back to Africa.
Mother Africa, that's the legacy which has been passed down to me. That's what Duke was all about. For me, just to open up that wonderful continent and make people realize how deep and how much Mother Africa has given to the world.
Randy Weston recorded several albums for Riverside Records in the 1950s and wrote a few classic standards of modern jazz, including High Fly. High Fly took its inspiration from Africa and Randy's towering stature.
You know, if you're very tall, the ground looks different to you than somebody shorter, you know. So it was like a takeoff on myself. At the same time, it was inspired by an African rhythm that I heard, and I put that to the piano. But it was humorous, it was comical, High Fly.
Randy went to Nigeria in 1961. It changed his life. He became drenched in the continent's music and spirit. African percussionist Babatunde Olatunji says Randy taps into the sound of Africa.
It's the hit on the piano and the drum. R- Randy is a big man, you know, with fantastic, beautiful hands, you know.
Pianist Billy Taylor says that Randy Weston is still creating his legacy.
I think Randy epitomizes the Afrocentric approach to the music. He has done it better than most.
Randy Weston, Out of Africa, next on Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson.